encase the press are waiting with their photographs, and will make people upset in the newspapers by saying Joanna Lumley is mouldering away in front of your eyes. Tragic figure, stamping about in Clapham.
For almost two decades on Radio 4, these interviews were an appointment to listen. Professor Clare's professional calling card and considerable insight meant he had the permission and ability to explore the very deepest and sometimes darkest recesses of people's character and compulsions. Along with that, he possessed one of the greatest gifts an interviewer can display, the ability to dance in the moment. Just listen to this encounter with historian and author Norman Stone.
In the psychiatrist's chair, Professor Anthony Clare talks to Professor Norman Stone.
Not one of the biggest names he spoke to, but for me, it exemplifies the professor's razor-sharp broadcasting style. Here, Stone, a formidable intellect, seems most comfortable dealing with Clare's questioning by throwing up a sort of smokescreen of intellectual references. But in his attempt to obscure himself from the good doctor, it seems he was underestimating the tenacity of the man across the table.
You know, what kind of person were you?
The greatest French book which I came to read was Proust. And I can only say that your question indicates, vous dites cela parce que vous ne connaissez pas la vie.
Go on, translate that for me.
You say that because you do not know life. Some fool said something about the eternal feminine.
Well, go on, you tell me about that.
Das ewig weibliche zieht uns doch heran.
That I need a translation of.
You know your Goethe.
I know my Goethe, but I don't know that well.
Oh, the eternal feminine.
And Clare did know his Goethe and his Proust and the rest, but among his greatest talents was finding a common language with each of his subjects. He met guests on their own ground and then gently introduced ideas from his world of psychiatry, subtly demystifying the therapeutic process at a time when most people viewed it with a degree of suspicion. One of the leading psychiatrists of his generation, Clare, was head of psychological medicine at St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London, professor of psychiatry at Trinity College Dublin, and he held several other senior posts. Not perhaps the sort of person you'd expect to find presenting a popular radio show. But his fusion of psychiatric techniques, superb voice, and incisive interviewing was the perfect mix.
Overall, I think it was an absolutely marvellous programme, and making it possible for people to speak about psychological issues when it was still shaming. It opened up the general public to psychiatry not being such a scary thing, and actually even high-achieving famous people get mental troubles. You know, in other words, it can affect everybody.
This is forensic psychiatrist Dr. Karine Min. I asked her what she and Clare's other contemporaries thought at the time of In the Psychiatrist's Chair.
I remember the discussions in the Maudsley Hospital canteen and at the Institute of Psychiatry, and most of us couldn't wait for the next episode.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So it was very well regarded among the community, the mental health community.
By and large. Some people were critical, and of course we would have these discussions over lunch and say, but you know, when she or he said that, you know, he didn't follow it up, you know, he went on to something else and he missed an opportunity. So we would have lively debates about it.
I don't know if you've heard the Professor Norman Stone interview, is that
I
one?
I did, yes.
Okay, well, I was listening to that again. Gosh, so much meat on the bone there. And
yeah.
Professor Stone is so adept at using his education and his intellect to obfuscate, you know, the French quotes come flowing thick and fast. And he plays a sort of game, I think, to see if Anthony Clare can keep up with him, which he very easily more than does. But Anthony Clare does, in the end, manage to really get to the meat of the matter.
Your mother looks, from what I read about her, a serious sort of person.
Oh, yes, my mother was a very good egg, but she was...
And it was a serious
She was a perfectibility of man, lady.
She was?
Oh, very much so.
But, are you? I wouldn't have thought so. What about the perfectibility of Norman Stone and these striking...
That interview in particular showed what a great listener Anthony Clare was, because no matter how far Norman Stone went with his intellectual references, he was not focusing on the content, but coming back to in what way he might have been speaking about that to avoid something else. But he did it in a very subtle way.
Now, do you have much recollection of your years at the Academy?
Oh, Oh, yes.
Well, you weren't sporty, you weren't athletic.
No, I was a blob.
So what did you... How did you carve out reputation?
I was the Nijinsky of French vocabulary.
So you used your intellectual skill. What were you like?
Oh, I must have been an intolerable kind of bush intellectual blob.
So you weren't a tearaway?
Oh, no. Good God.
A radical.
Incredible goody-goody.
Well, then what happened? When you left the academy, what did you do? Blob, you say, grey. Yeah. And apparently, if I'd been anywhere around you, I wouldn't have particularly noticed you. Then what changed? Because no one, Norman, would describe the postgraduate Norman Stone in anything like that kind of way. So, come on, either it wasn't like that, or it was, and something changed dramatically.
Very often, he will preface a question by saying, can I ask you something? I have realised in re-listening to these interviews that that's something I myself have done, or I've also said, I'm going to ask you something here, and I don't know if you want to answer it. Mm. Psychologically, what are we doing as interviewers when we're doing that?
I think probably what's happening there is there's an anticipation of the anxiety that the question might provoke, so that by virtue of anticipating the anxiety, you're dissipating it.
I see.
And I think it enables the person to open up more than they would otherwise if you, for example, had asked the question very directly. It's almost like a communication. I can understand that this might make you anxious or you might not want to go there, but let's see what we can do together because I'm on your side.
I'm on your side, and also, is it maybe you are in control of this?
Yeah. And I think what was very interesting about how he carried out his interviews was that he used a fusion of the bullet points of what we would call a psychiatric interview that we were trained in. Funnily enough, I was also at the Maudsley Hospital, so I know the training that Anthony Clare went through. He used the three main bullet points fused with a journalistic approach, asking very open questions and following them up and then coming back to something that had been perhaps avoided.
Tell me about those three points then. What are those three pegs?
The three main pegs are, why are you here? With a patient, we might ask when we meet them for the first time, what brings you here? Something may have been troubling you that brings you to my psychiatry outpatient clinic. His take was, why have you agreed to be interviewed?
Yes.
And then the second main area was focusing on personal background history, aspects from the person's childhood that may have led to how they became what they became and how they are what they are, and in what way that informs their present, which is what he also focused on. That was the third main area.
It was often that second area, when guests in the chair spoke about their background and childhood, that of course proved most revealing.
Your accounts of the first years in India.
You mean you found the accounts? God, I thought I'd burnt them.
Spike Milligan's interview from the very first series in 1982 is one to savour. Famous from his starring role in the Goons radio comedy and self-professed grown-up child, Milligan's early years loom large in this complex, ambivalent, sad and funny conversation.
My childhood was like a litmus paper in the sun. It recorded it very well and I appreciated it very well.
Were you happy?
I don't think I was quite happy. I wet the bed a lot, which is usually a sign of psychological unhappiness.
Claire is comfortable running with Milligan's restlessness and strangeness, and as a result, we gain glimpses of vivid and at times grotesque childhood memories that betray the same eye for the absurd that would later characterise Milligan's comedy.
Would you say that you were a sensitive child?
Yes, ultra-sensitive. I was very aware of cruelty. I don't know why. Instance was, we were walking in the back of the houses in Pune, and they used to shoot the pariah dogs, or pariah, we call them pariah. And the dog shooter saw this pariah, and he shot it, and he blew it in two, except the spine was still connected. And I noticed that dog's guts were blown all over the place, but its tail was still wagging a bit. And this chap actually went... this gun shooter, and it wagged its tail for him. And I said to him, please put it out of its misery. And then he did. He shot it again. I remember the bullet entered its head and blew both his eyes out, like, came out like on stalks.
What age were you then?
About six, seven. Yeah.
We learn that Milligan had had his fair share of the world's cruelty. The pair also discussed his numerous bouts of deep depression with striking candidness and curiosity.
I was very strange. I was very strange indeed. I was mentally ill, no two ways about it. I shouldn't have been working, but I had to hang on to this job. It was a very good job. And I went in and out of mental homes, but once every 6 months.
But at this time, when you say you were ill, you were turning out classic comedy material.
It's amazing, yeah. It was amazing.
Could you have done it if you hadn't been ill?
I must have... It's a strange thing you say this, Tony. The best scripts I wrote were when I was ill. Mm. There was a mad desire to be better than anybody else at comedy. And if I couldn't do it in the given time of 8 hours a day, I used to work 12, 13 and 14.
Mm.
I did. I was determined. There was a time when I was positively manic.
The interview was the beginning of a collaboration between the two men that resulted in the publication of a 1993 book titled Depression and How to Survive It. Milligan's melancholia wasn't perhaps that surprising, but the same can't be said for another funny man whose much more mainstream comic persona gave away little of his complex background.
I know that I was an accident. I didn't intend to have another child after John because that came up in a couple of arguments I had once or twice with my mother.
Comedian and TV frontman Bob Monkhouse sat in the psychiatrist's chair in 1992.
I was full of fun, and I wanted affection from her, but she never was physically affectionate with me at all. What I got from her was a very clear message that you don't show your feelings in public. You don't cry, and you don't laugh out loud. I remember one occasion, I must have been about 10. I was playing in the garden as the sun went down, and I must have trod on the little apples that fall from the tree, and my leg twisted underneath me, and I fractured the tibia and the fibula on my left leg. And I began to scream, and my mother rushed into the garden, and her concern was for my screaming annoying the neighbours, rather than for the fact I was in pain.
Monkhouse was a man whose perma grin and smooth delivery was made for the primetime shiny floor shows of my youth.